My name is Nada Ahmed, and I am your host for the Braving Innovation Podcast. I believe every company and team can bring new products and services to market and achieve immense success in creating sustainable and profitable business models. Through this podcast, I bring to you inspiring stories, tips, and strategies from leaders all around the world so that you can excel on your journey as an entrepreneur, innovation leader, and investor. Welcome to Braving Innovation.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode at Braving Innovation. And this week, I have the pleasure of having with me Yona Rapishti, who has recently started a new role at the International Center for Research on Women in Washington, D.C., and was previously a social entrepreneurship manager at MIT D-Lab, where she managed MIT's D-Lab's Scale-Up Fellowship, a global accelerator working with local entrepreneurs, bringing poverty-alleviating products and services to emerging markets at scale. And Yona has worked over the past couple of years a lot with, in particular, on the subject of gender lens investing and female entrepreneurs. So we'll touch on a lot of those topics today. Welcome, Yona.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Nada. I'm just excited to be here and start my day with this conversation with you.
Yeah, it's early in the morning for you, huh? So to start off with, our tradition here at Braving Innovation is I often ask my guests to share a time with us when they had to be exceptionally brave, when you had to really muster a lot of courage and do something that required courage.
Yeah, it's just such a good question. And it really got me thinking about way back into my life. I think we could all use a dose of being brave in the things that we do always, but that's not always the case. So one of the things that really came to mind when you asked me this question was my very first kind of journey in my professional life, and that was being an entrepreneur. So I had just studied in the U.S., but I originally come from Albania, from Tirana. And I had job offers. I had a lot of opportunities to stay here after I finished university, but I actually decided to go back to Albania. And I started looking at, well, what is it that I can do that's like different? And there's kind of like an opening there. And it was risky because there was a lot of pressure from my parents and others to just settle into a more traditional career. And instead, I joined a social movement, and within that ended up starting a small foundation. And the role of that foundation was to think about philanthropy and how can you embed philanthropy in this country where, because of communism, because of like transition to democracy, there were people that were making money, but they weren't really thinking about how to apply that newfound wealth to social causes and how to be kind of ingrained into the changes in society. So that's the work that I did. I had no experience in it. I really didn't have that many connections, but it was just a really interesting and kind of break from the things that I thought I was originally going to do. And so it was almost my first try to be a social entrepreneur myself. And ever since then, I had been thinking a lot about how do I support other people that are starting on these journeys and might not necessarily have the networks and the know-how, and how can you plug them in to make them more successful?
So you started your social entrepreneurship journey quite early then. So you said this was right after school. Mm-hmm. And was that sort of then what led you to end up doing what you've done over the past couple of years, really focus on social entrepreneurship?
Yeah. So I did that for a couple of years. And then, to tell you the truth, being a social entrepreneur, as many will tell you, it's very draining. And it's very challenging. And from starting to build something on my own, I actually wanted to be part of and try to be part of a larger organization that is more systematically kind of supporting entrepreneurs. So I spent some years at the UN, but after that, I joined MIT D-Lab, and I was tasked with helping build the entrepreneurship portfolio there. So I started this and started kind of really building and changing the in-house accelerator program that was called the Scale Up Fellowship. And
D-Lab at MIT has this really kind of unique approach in through all of its programs. The idea is, how can we use participatory design? How can we really include the voices of people that are traditionally left out of the design of products, services, programs, et cetera, and kind of make those voices and center those voices into the program? So I did a lot of that with my work at the Scale Up Fellowship. And that's when I started thinking about the work and how do we really bring in entrepreneurs from emerging markets more into the fore, highlight their work for venture capitalists and investors in the US. And then I also started thinking a lot about the gender component. And that has been really kind of my focus, like you said, over the last few years.
Yeah, so I really find fascinating what you're, the aspect around design, right? Like, how can we design better the systems that allow for maybe perhaps more social entrepreneurship? So what did you learn? What role can design play in solving development challenges?
Yeah. So I'll, before I get into design, I'll even like step back a little bit and share one of my biggest aha moments as I started thinking about gender. So two things happen at the same time, serendipitously. First is this really interesting report came out, and it was from IFC, the World Bank, and Village Capital. And they had looked at entrepreneurs that had were attending accelerator programs and learning about investment readiness. And, you know, entrepreneurs coming in were almost at the same baseline, and some were men and some were women. And what they found out in this massive study was that, first of all, men already came in with a big funding advantage over women. So men had about 1.6 times more money than women when they came into the accelerator program. But then after both of them were receiving investment readiness trainings, at the end of the program and in the months after that, you would expect this funding gap to close. But instead, the gap was getting bigger. So it was kind of a really big question that got me started on this journey. It's, you know, why are these accelerator programs, why are these investment readiness programs really failing female founders? And how are they not helping kind of like close the gap as they intend to and be those connectors between entrepreneurs and the funders? So at the same time as I was thinking about this, I stumbled upon a really interesting book that's called Invisible Women. And so it's by Caroline Criado Perez, and it talks about data gaps, and particularly about how we design transportation system, infrastructure, urban planning, how we diagnose and treat people. And we do that for the default male in our society. And by doing that, it means that women are just disadvantaged. For example, like one example I always think of is seatbelts were designed for the 70 kilogram tall male, and hence women that got into car accidents for a long time had 50% higher chances of being injured, etc. So when I thought about these two things, I started thinking about how the way that we train female founders, our investment readiness curriculum is also designed for the default male, how we do pitch programs, et cetera. So how can we really rethink the way that, and how can we redesign, going back to your question, the way that we run our programs in a way that really takes into account the unique journey of female founders in the fundraising ecosystem? It's true that women interact with the same actors, but the interactions are not the same. Women are experiencing bias, sometimes very subtle differences in how investors interact with them and how the spaces are set up, time poverty, et cetera. And so more and more, I started thinking about kind of reimagining this kind of training to really start addressing these biases and do that in an evidence-based way, because more and more studies now are coming out. And a great place to look at that is, for example, the Harvard Gender Action Portal, where they have about 300 studies that look at these like differences in how men and women compete differently, how investors ask different questions of women, et cetera. So more and more, we have evidence to know what these hiccups in the system are, and we just need to redesign with those things in mind to really help female founders succeed.
Yeah, this is such an important work that you're doing because the data speaks for itself, right? We've seen, like you're saying, the data, instead of us figuring out a way when women entrepreneurs enter these accelerator programs, the gap is widening instead of doing the opposite. And what do you think, what were kind of your main learnings of why this is happening? Because when I talk to a lot of investors, you know, they say, well, they just evaluate both men and women the same way, without really realizing that maybe that's where the problem lies.
Yeah, that is absolutely so insightful. When you speak to VCs, because of the nature of the system, and this is a system that's very well embedded, what you'll hear is that it's a pipeline problem, or that, you know, we're doing all we can, we're reaching out, and yet it's not working. What a lot of the programs actually focus on, like, building the capacity of female founders rather than rethinking how the systems could be redesigned differently. And so I have a lot to say. I think I'll try to maybe make three points or three levers that I think investors can use to get outside of that mindset of, you know, there's no pipeline and we're doing the best to evaluate, but women are falling short. So the first one is this idea that is coming out more and more in my conversations and the research that I've been doing, which is that there's really an insider-outsider problem when it comes to venture capital. In many cases, venture capital is a social capital game. So it's about who you know. And there are certain signals about what has made founders successful in the past that VCs and investors tries to translate to see if, you know, someone is worthy and someone's going to be successful in the future. So I call this like a really big monoculture, right? I think famously Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, said, "I can be fooled by anyone that looks like Mark Zuckerberg." Because that's a prototype of like the white man of Silicon Valley out of your garage. So anyone that looks outside that doesn't look the part just isn't really brought into the fold. And we don't know how to find these outliers. And that's really the big tension, right? Because that's when VCs really make those outsized returns, is when they can really identify those outliers, when they can really identify those outsiders. So how do we really kind of like bridge this moat between who looks like the people? And so one interesting funder and the person that I really like is, his name is Matt Sherman. And he always talks about, let's build on the other side of the moat, where these outsiders are, and let's create kind of these parallel systems that could serve them.
Well, I love that, because one of the things I've heard now as I'm talking to a lot of VCs, as I'm taking this program on venture capital, sort of the big advice that they give, or, you know, one of the ways that they select who they're going to give funding to, especially these big fund managers, is if these people have had success before. If they're sort of a serial entrepreneur, then they don't have to ask a lot of questions. They're going to get my money, right? And there's inherent bias within that.
Yeah, there's absolutely inherent bias on that. And the other thing that I'll mention is that bias is also compounded, right? It's like one system, like warm introductions, or the need to have warm introductions, which are basically like, I will not talk to you unless someone in my network also introduces and brings you to the fore, right? And investors will say, for example, like, warm introductions are great because it helps me realize that this founder is a hustler. They will somehow go find someone in my network and reach. And when you take that into account and you think about that, it seems really good because, yes, there is some hustling that's required. But when you think of it from the entrepreneur perspective, the entrepreneur has to meet 200 VCs. So they have to hustle 200 times. So is that too much of an unfair burden? So that's one thing.
And sort of the language that we use, right? Hustling, it's a very sort of masculine language, and kind of realizing that if you're going to create a more inclusive space, you have to be also open to entrepreneurs approaching the whole investment game in a very different way.
Absolutely. Because if there's only one system, if there's only one path, then people will drop off that might not necessarily, you know, be willing to always play that game that's set up for people not like them. And so the thing that's really interesting, like the one that you mentioned, Nada, which is having a CV that shows that you've succeeded in the past, being able to, you know, get this warm introduction, having attended a very prestigious accelerator, all of these are important signals. But what it ends up is setting up a system that's increasingly kind of like stacked up about certain kinds of founder. And so each of these might be 5% inefficient in letting in founders that are different. But when you stack them up together, that's when you really start creating this gap. And so it's so important for investors to think about, well, how can we change, particularly, I think, the sourcing and due diligence part, which is really that's where the pipeline is really big. And that's where a lot of these biases really come into play. How can they zoom in and think about redesigning them in different ways? And one of the recommendations that I have in one of the pilots that I ran around that is, well, can we help bring in female founders into the mold and help them co-design together with investors about what these new processes will be? And it's different. It's not something that's, you know, it's really changing kind of the rules of the game of how investors work. But I think the thing that I would always say is an investor would never work with an entrepreneur that isn't designing for their customers. So if investors can look at female founders as a new customer that they want to bring into their pipeline, then it's important to really get to know them and to really work with them.
You said you had two more points. Did you also already mention one of them?
Yeah. So the process one and these like compound processes is another one. And then the third one that I will mention is that there's also not just a bias for, you know, how we interact, but there's a bias for masculine versus feminine thing. The market tends to value very often kind of masculine products, masculine ways of being, et cetera. So just to go back to another really interesting fact that I read in a book not too long ago, which was Who Cooks Adam Smith's Dinner, is really interesting. It said that about 150 years ago, electric cars were invented. And they were invented for women who didn't like the noise and smell of like the diesel and the other cars. But because they were invented for women, they just really didn't take off. The market, they had about 20% of the market share, and then they were just seen as like too feminine. And so the other dominant model of car was the one that took hold. And where are we today, you know, with that? Now, increasingly, men are driving the adoption of electric cars, but we could have gotten there faster, right? So thinking about female consumers and what they like and what they value is something that investors need to think about better. I've worked with a lot of female entrepreneurs that have amazing fintech, and they say that they talk to investors, and a male investor say, you know, I just don't get that market. I just don't get who would be interested in this. Okay. And so how can we flip that and think about assigning really value to things that female consumers value, and look at that as like a big potential market.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we also need more investors on the other side of the table, women investors who are making these decisions, and not saying that all of those women then will also be able to adapt, because it's very easy for us women to enter a very masculine environment and then adapt to the culture because that's how we're really accepted. And I think it's such an interesting point that you're making about how we as a society value masculine things more than feminine things. And just the other day, you know, I have a girl and a boy as two kids, and often people kind of degrade things that girls play with, like, oh, I didn't buy any dolls for my daughter because I wanted her to play with cars, like all the masculine things. And and there's kind of bias included in that. Why is caring for a small baby considered less valuable? And why is it more valuable to be playing with boys' toys, right? So it starts at a very early age, something that we put into young kids' mind, even when we're, our intention is to not have that disparity.
That is such a good point. And particularly because it does start at a such young age, right? And the example that you give is like, that's why the care economy, so many people are trying to bring that to the fold and actually get investors to look at that. So it's like, and the other thing that your comment really makes me think about is that, you know, we do have to be careful when we talk about gender and like, I've come late into this. I was more of the, on the camp where like we can, as women, you know, we need to try hard and we need to just like really push through and we'll make it, you know, but the more I kind of understand the structural biases, the more I am inclined to work and be part of like finding solutions for them. But we really have to pull together the two sides, and this cannot be solved, you know, which is like criticizing men and the systems, but how do we really bring men and women together to kind of like solve these problems and make it more comfortable? It's one of the other critiques that I have is that, you know, the people that do care about bringing diversity into the VC, very often those are rooms full of women. And how to really bring the male voices, the male allies, and kind of build momentum on both sides. It's not easy to do, but hopefully the idea is that we won't always have to talk about supporting women as a separate kind of category. We really need to bring that into the mainstream, and this hopefully shouldn't be an issue. Where we just have to like build these separate structures, build these separate programs to really solve these challenges that we've just been discussing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, often I've heard people say like, oh, there's not enough room, like when they're looking for partners, well, we already have these partners, but you can always extend the table, right? You can always add more chairs. So it's moving away from this kind of lack scarcity mindset to, let's work together. And I think that's one of the big values that we women bring in is collaboration and really looking at it from that collaborative mindset. And I think this year too, as I've been attending some of the sort of female conferences and stuff, I feel like I am kind of past that stage of, you know, blaming or pointing. It's more about, okay, how do we come together? How do we get more men in the room when we're talking about these things? And how do we figure out a way together? Because it's going to be beneficial for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that kind of creating or solving problems from multiple perspectives and in this collaboration that I think will be really impactful.
Mm. Yeah. So another thing you've spoken about is around the type of questions that VCs ask men and women quite differently. And there's quite some research there. And I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about what's a promotion question and what's a prevention question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was a study by a group, two female researchers, one at Columbia University and one at Harvard. And they were really interested at looking at the interaction between VCs and entrepreneurs. And so they started being part of all these conversations and really started cataloging the questions that they saw were being asked. And they started seeing that basically two types of questions emerge, as you mentioned. So one is promotion questions. And these are questions that, as an entrepreneur, ask you, what is your vision? How big can this get? You know, what are these, how are you going to grow big? How are you going to win, basically, with this game? Like, what's the end vision and how is that end vision going to be successful? So when entrepreneurs get asked these kind of questions, they basically open up and really talk about winning big. And as you know, VCs have a bias towards really companies that will scale. The other type of question is a prevention question. So these are the type of questions that ask you how you're not going to lose. So what they do is they start by saying, it seems like one of the risks is competitors, market is small, et cetera. Can you tell me how you're going to overcome this challenge? So What these kind of questions do is that they help you look really narrowly at the problems that are happening in your company right now and talk about them. So the conversation in the end ends up about how you're going to overcome problems. So in the mind of the investor, it helps them, it makes them see you as someone that just has a lot of hurdles to clear. And you don't talk very much about the future of the company. So what these two researchers found, not just that there's two types of questions, but that women get asked prevention questions twice as much as men. And as a result, they get funded much less. So it's actually one of those examples where it just happens very, it seems like naturally, you don't know that you're going into this loop of just talking about the challenges and you don't break out of the loop. The investor comes out thinking, well, they're not going to be doing very much, you know, like look at all the challenges. And so that's what happens. And so the really interesting thing about research, the research is that you can break this loop. So if entrepreneurs, whether they're female founders or even entrepreneurs working in risky markets from, you know, Africa, Asia, et cetera, they also get asked questions about risk a lot. If you can answer that question, not deflect it, but really kind of answer it, and then spend a little bit of time kind of projecting your vision about the company in a way that's still authentic and projecting about why you will be a good founder, then that seems to flip the conversation. It flips the flow. And so that's one of the kind of like modules that I've been working on, and I have a series of modules around these evidence-based kind of hurdles that women face. And how can we teach to that and speak to that? So it's not about just teaching women to pitch, but how do we teach women to pitch in ways that will help them overcome the unique challenges that they will encounter?
Yeah, that really resonates with me, because I have been, you know, not pitching as a founder, but I have been in interview rooms where I kept on being asked questions like, would you be able to present to the board, you know, which is all male, all white, over 50? Are you confident? And, you know, these are all prevention questions, and it's really limiting on how you answer them. So it's really good to get that advice from you that you can still kind of answer that question, but then move towards, this is what I want to create. This is what I can do, and use sort of that question to also talk about your vision. That is usually more inspiring than putting yourself in this kind of defensive position where you're really defending that you are the right person for the role.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's being able to get out of like the pigeonholing that happens, not always with malicious intent, like we discussed, you know, but yeah.
So that's interesting, because there are these unconscious bias that exist. So as women, we will be faced with some of these questions. So you're teaching women with skills so that we can sort of maneuver in the environment that already exists, but at the same time, you're working to design a space that in which we don't have to do that, right? Because in the long term, that's the more sustainable solution, that we don't have to always have to maneuver through these questions. How can we make people more aware? And I think it also starts with having more women in these spaces, right? When these VCs get used to seeing more women pitching, when they get to see more women succeeding and having women as leaders, we can somehow change that perception.
Mm-hmm. I like how you use the word maneuver, because I always say it's like teaching them like defensive driving in the short term, so they don't bump into these counters. Yeah. And it also it improves their overall experience with the process if they know what to expect and are better prepared for it. But you're completely right. It's a long-term vision that we all need to work towards. Hmm.
So we're quickly getting towards the end of the time, but I thought before we end, because you've also worked a lot with developing countries, if you could share maybe some of your stories from working with these female entrepreneurs in these challenging environments and how they've been able to overcome some of the challenges that they've had.
Yeah. So when I became interested in this topic, I started actually like reaching out to female founders that have raised, you know, at least $500,000, but up to much, much more, in different markets, and interviewing them just to kind of like catalog their experiences. And then I realized that they were all asking me, well, what are the other founders saying? So I started this Instagram account that is a little bit a knockoff from like Humans of New York, that catalogs the experiences of female founders in emerging markets with fundraising in particular and leadership. And so the stories are so varied and so interesting. So that's a good place to go and read. And it's called Global Scale Up X, and it's on Instagram. But the one thing that I will say, Nada, that was very interesting is that, you know, for female founders, being a woman is both sometimes challenging. And so a lot of the things we talked about, they've sensed and they've grappled with for sure within their journey. You know, they've had bias towards them within VCs, but also sometimes with their own employees. They have had struggles to connect to the right networks, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, it's also this positive thing, like a benefit. Like they see so much power into being a woman about like how they build their teams. It's one of the really interesting stories, you know, kind of this idea of bringing female leadership to the fore where they can really, for example, build these like safe, holistic companies that value different types of conversations. They value different types of like how you manage and your time and how you think about conflict, etc. So a lot of these women are innovating and really using their experience as women and into like how they lead their company. So I think that's been super exciting for me to track and catalog and think about.
Yeah, that sounds very inspiring. Sometimes you see women, especially in these challenging environments, really using the constraints that they have as levers, right? So that's great. So I thought maybe we could end with you telling us a little bit about what you're doing now at the International Center on Research for Women, and what your plans are ahead for using all the experience that you've gained, all the research that you've done on the challenges that women face and what we can do about it.
Yeah. So ICRW is a well-established organization that does like research and advocacy on behalf of like global issues that affect women all around the world. But within ICRW, there's a smaller group that's called ICRW Advisors. And that's a group that I've joined. And it's basically like a gender boutique consultancy. They mainly work with corporations, Nike, Amazon, Meta, really all of the big multilateral corporates that are working all around the world and helping them think about how can they be more gender inclusive in their supply chains, particularly. Also in their strategies, programs, in the innovation and the work that we do. So I was really interested. I'd work with accelerators, investors, entrepreneurs, and I really started thinking about, well, how are corporations thinking about this? What are their incentives? And so now I work with this exciting group of clients on various projects. And at the same time, I'm helping ICRW also build a portfolio of projects with impact investors, because that's one area that I'm really passionate about and I want to continue to do. So it's exciting. It's a really small group, so there's a lot of opportunity to grow. But I always wanted to learn about the incentives in the corporate sector. And I think because they have so much money, a lot of them work already with entrepreneurs as partners in accelerators, et cetera. So I think it's going to tie a lot of the different strands of the things that I've been really excited about. And it was sad to leave MIT, but it's a new and exciting chapter.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're a great asset for ICRW Advisors. And I think there's a big demand for the kind of services that you're offering all around the world. I think everyone's waking up to the limitations of not including 50% of the population into our economy and into the decisions that we're making. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Super inspiring. I think we learned a lot today. And I can't wait to follow you further and see what great insights you bring to us on some of the barriers that we are facing and what we can do about it.
Thank you, Nada. As you know, I'm one of your biggest fans as well. So it was just such a pleasure to be here. And I love these conversations that you've been having. So thank you. And and we will definitely, I know our paths will cross often.
Yes, they will. Thank you. And if anyone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
So you can find me on LinkedIn and just drop me a message.
Yeah. Okay. We'll put that in the notes also. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Braving Innovation Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe so you do not miss any of our future episodes. Don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with others who might find it valuable. Thank you.